October 31st, 1981. Juanita, Florida. The mother of 13-year-old Tina Marie Janos wakes up to discover that she is missing from their mobile home. That same evening, Tina Marie's body is found 12 miles away on Interstate 4, and it turns out she was abducted and murdered before the killer tossed her off a highway overpass. Over the years, two offenders with a history of harming young girls pop up on the radar as suspects, but there is no conclusive evidence pointing to either of them, so Tina Marie's murder remains unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering an unsolved crime involving a 13-year-old girl, the 1981 murder of Tina Marie Janos. We are now in October, and per our yearly tradition, I always like to spend the last few weeks of the month covering mysteries with some sort of Halloween slant to them, and this year, I'll be profiling a couple of cases which just happened to take place on or around October the 31st. Earlier this year, I wound up learning about the unsolved murder of a 13-year-old girl named Tina Marie Janos, who was abducted from her mobile home in Juanita, Florida by an unknown perpetrator during the early morning hours of Halloween. This person then proceeded to sexually assault and murder Tina Marie before tossing her body off a highway overpass onto Interstate 4. Now, about 8 months later, another girl from the same county would also be abducted from her bedroom and tossed off an overpass onto the same interstate, but she wound up surviving and identified the perpetrator as a suspect named James Norman Ulmer. Under normal circumstances, Ulmer probably seems like the most obvious perpetrator, but several years later, law enforcement announced that another man named Frank Potts was also being looked at as a potential suspect, as he had an extensive history of sexually abusing young girls, and was apparently in the Juanita area around the time Tina Marie was killed. There is a compelling case for both of these men being the killer, and there seems to be sharply divided opinions from different investigators about whether Ulmer or Potts committed this crime. However, there is no real conclusive evidence pointing to either of them, and this is the reason that no one has ever been charged with Tina Marie's murder. So on this episode, we're going to explore all the different angles and try and determine whether Ulmer, Potts, or perhaps an unknown third party is the most likely candidate to have been responsible for this murder. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of these sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to mention that we're now getting close to attaining 500 Patreon subscribers, and if we manage to attain our goal by the end of October, we'll be providing an additional extra special bonus for all of our patrons in November. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of Tina Marie Janos. Our story begins in 1981 in Juanita, Florida, a small town located in Polk County just over 50 miles east of Tampa, which currently has a population of around 4,400 people. Our central figure is 13-year-old Tina Marie Janos, who lives in a mobile home on Spires Road with her mother, LaGuan Reynolds, and two younger siblings, an 8-year-old brother named Chet, and a 3-year-old sister named Lisa. 2 years earlier, Tina Marie's parents divorced, and her father, Chester Janos, moved to Michigan, and her mother is now involved in a relationship with a man named Jimmy Whitfield. Tina Marie is an 8th grade student at Denison Junior High School and known for being a very sweet girl with a devout love of animals. She aspires to become a veterinarian and takes care of a number of pet rabbits whom she keeps inside a hutch in her backyard. On the evening of Friday, October the 30th, Tina Marie prepared for Halloween by eating junk food and watching some scary movies on TV with her mother LaGuan, and they were also joined by LaGuan's boyfriend Jimmy, who was planning to spend the night. While Chet had his own bedroom, Tina Marie shared a room with Lisa, and she wound up going to bed at 11 p.m. At around 1 a.m. on October the 31st, LaGuan and Jimmy said that they decided to go to bed together, but sometime within the next 6 hours, Tina Marie would become the victim of an abduction. At 7 a.m. that morning, LaGuan was awakened by the sound of Lisa crying, and when she took her daughter back to her bedroom, she was surprised to discover that Tina Marie was not there. After waking up Jimmy, LaGuan proceeded to perform a search of the trailer and the backyard, but when she could not find Tina Marie anywhere, she called the Polk County Sheriff's Office at 7:20 in order to report her missing. Well, LaGuan did not realize that her daughter had already been found 35 minutes earlier. At 6:45 a.m., the Polk County Sheriff's Office had received another phone call from a motorist at a truck stop who reported having seen the body of a young girl on Interstate 4. When police arrived at the scene, they discovered this victim's partially nude body lying face down in the middle of the eastbound lane between the Mount Olive Road overpass. The girl had been beaten on her face and upper body, and the beating was reportedly so severe that one of Tina Marie's neighbors would tell the press that you could see some of her bones. Her hands were also tied behind her back with a gold bedsheet, and a lavender nightgown was wrapped around her neck, and it was apparent that she had been tossed over 20 feet from the overpass onto the interstate. Since this location was only 12 miles from Tina Marie's home, LaGuan's phone call immediately made the sheriff's office suspect that Tina Marie was the victim. Only about 40 minutes after she called the police, LaGuan was paid a visit by the sheriff's office, who showed them crime scene photos of her daughter. LaGuan immediately recognized the victim as Tina Marie, which caused her to start crying and going into hysterics, so Tina Marie's maternal uncle would have to be brought to the morgue to view her body and make a positive identification. It would later be confirmed that Tina Marie had borrowed the nightgown which was wrapped around her neck from her mother before she went to bed the previous night, and the gold sheet which was tied around Tina Marie's hands came from her bedroom. The coroner would also confirm that Tina Marie had been sexually assaulted, and her exact cause of death was strangulation via ligature, and she was likely killed sometime between 3 and 5 a.m., about 2 to 4 hours before her body was discovered. It seemed apparent that Tina Marie had been abducted in the middle of the night, but a search of her family's trailer failed to turn up much in the way of evidence, and there were no signs of a break-in or any struggle. Indeed, when LaGuan woke up, she discovered that the trailer's back door was unlocked, even though she was positive that she had locked it the previous evening, and did not believe her daughter would have left with anyone willingly. Since Tina Marie was always attempting to prevent stray animals, such as cats and raccoons, from entering her rabbit hutch in the backyard, one theory is that she may have been awakened by a noise in the middle of the night. Fearing that an animal may have entered the hutch, Tina Marie then unlocked the back door herself to go outside and check on the rabbits, but she was subsequently abducted. After members of the community pitched in for Tina Marie's funeral expenses, she was given a service and buried at Lakeside Memorial Park in Winter Haven. In early 1982, LaGuan took her two other kids and moved out of the mobile home, as she believed that the memories of Tina Marie's murder made it too painful for them to remain there. Well, 8 months after Tina Marie was killed, another similar crime would take place in the town of Kathleen, located about 25 miles northwest of Juanita. The victim this time around was 10-year-old Lisa Thompson, who was abducted from her mobile home during the early morning hours of June the 20th. The perpetrator entered Lisa's bedroom by removing a screen from one of the windows, and then proceeded to drive her away from the scene in his car. For the next few hours, he threatened to kill Lisa while driving around the area, but he never attempted to sexually assault her or touch her inappropriately. Shortly before 4 a.m., the abductor parked his vehicle on the old Combi Road overpass, which ran above Interstate 4, and proceeded to drag Lisa outside. He then tossed her off the overpass, but while Lisa managed to grab a hold of the railing, the perpetrator pried her hands loose and she plummeted down 24 feet onto the interstate before he fled the scene. But even though Lisa suffered a number of broken bones, she miraculously survived the fall and managed to get up and use her pajama top to flag down a passing car to get help. While Lisa was recovering in the hospital, she was asked to look through a photo lineup of mugshots, and she wound up positively identifying 24-year-old James Norman Ulmer as her abductor. Ulmer lived at his parents' residence in Lakeland, located about 8 miles from Kathleen, and had a previous arrest record for numerous offenses. 2 months earlier, on April the 16th, Ulmer had broken into a residence in Juanita while the teenage girl who lived there had a female friend over spending the night. Ulmer stood over the two girls and watched them while they were sleeping on the floor until the girl's mother spotted him and he fled the house and ran away. Believe it or not, Ulmer returned to the same residence and broke in again 2 weeks later on May the 2nd, but this time, the girl's father was waiting for him with a gun and held him at bay until he managed to call the police and they arrived to arrest him. He was charged with burglary with intent to commit battery and released on bond until Lisa Thompson's abduction took place, but following Lisa's identification, Ulmer was arrested again and charged with kidnapping, burglary, and attempted first-degree murder. To corroborate her identification of Ulmer, Lisa was able to accurately recall many specific details about the maroon 1976 Camaro he had driven when he abducted her, such as beads hanging from the rearview mirror, a collection of country music tapes that were inside, and a large dent on the vehicle's exterior. In addition, Ulmer's fingerprint was found on the window ledge at Lisa's mobile home, and Lisa's fingerprints and Ulmer's palm print had been left behind on the overpass railing when he pried her hands loose. Since this location was only 13 miles from the spot on Interstate 4 where Tina Marie's body was found, and Ulmer had previously broken into another home in Juanita, he was investigated as a potential suspect in Tina Marie's murder. Ulmer did have some additional ties to Juanita, as one of his sisters lived near Tina Marie's residence, and he also had friends from the area whom he often visited. For the previous incident from Juanita, Ulmer's original charge of burglary with intent to commit battery was downgraded to trespassing, and when he went on trial in August of that year, he was found guilty and received a 1-year prison sentence. Ulmer's trial for the attack on Lisa Thompson took place in November, and LaGuan Reynolds decided to attend the trial since she knew that Ulmer was a potential suspect in her own daughter's murder. Ulmer was found guilty on all charges and received an 80-year prison sentence, which would run concurrently with the previous 1-year sentence for trespassing. Investigators attempted to question Ulmer about Tina Marie's murder on multiple occasions, but he refused to speak with them, and no evidence could be found to implicate him in the crime. The Polk County Sheriff's Office consulted with Dr. Phoebe Kelso, a criminal psychologist and professor from the University of California, who worked up a profile for Tina Marie's killer, and it turned out to be quite similar to a psychological profile which had been constructed for Ulmer. The majority consensus seemed to be that he was responsible for Tina Marie's death, but complications would ensue when another potential suspect popped up on the radar over a decade later. In March of 1994, Major Marvin Pittman of the Polk County Sheriff's Office held a press conference in which he announced that 50-year-old Frank Faneuil Potts was being looked at as a suspect in Tina Marie's death. Potts had recently been charged with another murder, and Pittman said that a 6-state task force had been assembled to look at the possibility that Potts was a serial killer who may have been responsible for as many as 15 murders. Potts already had a lengthy criminal history, and his offenses included beating up an 80-year-old relative when he was 19 years old. He was also known for living a transient lifestyle and worked odd jobs as a migrant fruit picker throughout the southeastern United States. 3 months before this press conference, Potts had been living in Highland City, which is just over 12 miles west of Juanita, and was arrested on an outstanding warrant. Potts owned a hunting cabin on Garrett Mountain in Jackson County, Alabama, near the unincorporated community of Estill Fork, and the previous year, he had been confronted by a wildlife officer about firing a machine gun on his property. Potts pointed his weapon at the officer and forced him to drop his gun, but the officer managed to run away and escape before he was harmed, and by the time the authorities swore out a warrant for his arrest, Potts had already fled the area. After being taken into custody, Potts was held without bail at the Polk County Jail, but he soon had new charges filed against him for sexual battery after he was accused of molesting a 10-year-old girl from Polk City. The girl claimed that Potts had threatened to kill her entire family if she told anyone what he did, so she only felt comfortable coming forward after learning he was in jail. Even before these charges were filed, Potts had always been a suspect in the disappearance of a 19-year-old Indianapolis man named Robert Earl Gines, who had not been seen since February of 1989. Gines and his girlfriend, Bobby Lee Harrell, had originally met Potts in Lakeland, but he convinced them to relocate to Alabama in order to stay with him at his cabin in Jackson County. However, Harrell claimed that shortly after they arrived, Gines just seemed to vanish without a trace, and when Potts started making sexual advances towards her, she decided to leave his cabin and flee the area. 2 months after Gines vanished, Harrell contacted the Jackson County Sheriff's Office and expressed her belief that Potts killed Gines because he wanted to have her as his own girlfriend. But Potts maintained that Gines took off on his own accord, and since there was no body or any other evidence of foul play, Jackson County authorities did not take any action for the next 5 years. However, following Potts' arrest, a massive search effort was performed of his 40-acre property on Garrett Mountain in March of 1994, and it wound up unearthing Gines' skeletal remains less than 200 yards from Potts' cabin. His cause of death was determined to be 2 blows to the head with a blunt instrument, so Potts was charged with Gines' murder. There was speculation that Potts might have the remains of additional victims buried on his property, but the search turned up nothing. In December of that year, Potts went on trial for the sexual battery of the 10-year-old girl, and after being found guilty, he received a sentence of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 25 years. Potts' trial for the murder of Robert Earl Gines would take place in April of 1995, and testimony was provided by a friend of Potts who had helped him bury Gines' body. Potts was once again found guilty and received an additional life sentence, which would be served consecutively with his previous sentence. In spite of an extensive investigation, no evidence could be found that Potts was responsible for additional murders, and he continued to maintain his innocence in all the crimes he was convicted of, alleging that he was a victim of a smear campaign from the Polk County Sheriff's Office. Regardless, a cold case unit with the Sheriff's Office decided to take a fresh look at Tina Marie Janos' murder and investigate Potts as a potential suspect. In February of 1981, Potts became separated from his wife and decided to move in with his mother in Lakeland, which is located about 20 miles northwest of Juanita. While there, Potts worked for a fruit contractor who lived only 4 blocks from where Tina Marie resided at that time. While Potts denied knowing Tina Marie, LeGuan thought his face looked familiar and believed that Potts had met both her and Tina Marie on at least one occasion. In an interesting bit of timing, Potts' wife would officially file for divorce from him on October the 30th of that year, just 1 day before Tina Marie was murdered. On Thanksgiving Day, less than 1 month after the murder, Potts' daughter was visiting him in Lakeland alongside an 11-year-old girlfriend of hers, and Potts proceeded to molest the friend while she was sleeping on the couch. Potts was soon arrested and went on trial for the crime in May of 1982, where testimony was provided by 2 of Potts' sisters who claimed that he had molested them while they were growing up. Potts was ultimately found guilty and convicted on the charges of lewd and lascivious sex acts against a child and received a 15-year prison sentence, but he only served 6 of those years before he was released in 1988 and relocated to Alabama. Following Potts' arrest for molesting his daughter's friend, the Polk County Sheriff's Office had investigated him as a potential suspect in Tina Marie's murder, but never found any evidence to implicate him, but of course, they decided to look at him again over a decade later. Potts continued to deny any involvement in the crime and claimed that he was in North Carolina picking apples with his girlfriend on the date Tina Marie was killed. Even though Major Marvin Pittman had publicly expressed his belief that Potts was a serial killer who had murdered many victims, including Tina Marie, other investigators believe that Pittman jumped the gun and overestimated how many crimes Potts was responsible for. Tina Marie's case would eventually be taken over by another Polk County detective named Louis Giampavolo, and while Potts has never been eliminated as a suspect, GM Pavolo has openly stated that he believes James Norman Ulmer was Tina Marie's killer. However, while serving his 80-year prison sentence at the Cross City Correctional Institute, Ulmer had to be transferred to DeSoto Memorial Hospital in Arcadia because of serious respiratory issues, and he wound up passing away on April the 16th, 1996, at the age of 37. And on June the 14th, 2023, only a few months before the release of this episode, Frank Potts died at the Sewanee Correctional Institution in Live Oak at the age of 79. Since DNA profiling was not yet a standard practice in homicide investigations back in 1981, there is some question about whether any of the evidence from Tina Marie's murder contains the perpetrator's DNA, which could allow the crime to be posthumously linked to either Ulmer or Potts. Regardless, the Polk County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Unit continues to periodically review Tina Marie's case, and for years, they would always reach out to LaGuan on Halloween in order to offer their condolences and keep her apprised of any updates. They continually reminded LaGuan that the investigation would remain open until the killer could be identified, but after 4 decades, Tina Marie's murder continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I first learned about this story when searching for cold cases to cover this year, which took place on Halloween, and wound up coming across a post about it on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. And this turned out to be a truly horrifying murder, as I can't think of too many other cases where a victim's body, let alone a teenage girl, was tossed from a highway overpass. There are many heartbreaking elements in this story, but one which really gets me is how Tina Marie Janos loved animals and went out of her way to care for the rabbit she kept in her backyard, and one of the most prominent theories for her abduction is that she may have gone outside in the middle of the night because she heard a noise and wanted to make sure that a stray animal didn't wind up inside the rabbit's hutch. When I started reading about this case and learned that James Norman Ulmer threw another girl from the same county off a highway overpass onto the same interstate only about 8 months after Tina Marie was killed, I said to myself, okay, this guy obviously did it, mystery solved. But then I learned about Frank Potts and thought there was a fairly compelling case for him being the perpetrator instead. Since both these suspects are now deceased, they will obviously never be charged with this crime, and if there isn't any usable DNA evidence that was preserved and can be used for genetic genealogy, it will be difficult to conclusively prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that either of them was Tina Marie's killer. If one of these men did it, then at least we can know that they spent the last years of their life in prison before they died, but it would be nice to know with absolute certainty. But of course, it's also possible that neither of them are responsible for Tina Marie's death, and she instead fell prey to someone who has never popped up on the radar as a potential suspect. So here's what we do know about this case. Tina Marie's mother, LaGuan, and her boyfriend, Jimmy Whitfield, both claim that Tina Marie went to bed at 11 p.m., and they personally turned in at 1 a.m. Tina Marie was discovered to be missing at 7 a.m. when her younger sister Lisa woke up and noticed that she was not in the room they shared together. Tina Marie's body was first noticed on Interstate 4 at 6:45 a.m., and her time of death was estimated to have been sometime between 3 and 5 o'clock. This means that Tina Marie had to have been abducted during a window of between 2 to 4 hours after her mother went to bed, but since there were no signs of forced entry or evidence of a struggle at the mobile home, how would this have taken place? Well, if you pull up the aforementioned post about this case at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, you'll see some comments there directing suspicion towards LaGuan's boyfriend, Jimmy Whitfield, who was spending the night there. Of course, at no point during the investigation did law enforcement ever say that they considered Jimmy to be a potential suspect, but I could see how him being the perpetrator would explain some of the oddities in this case. We know he was staying over at the trailer all night, and there were no signs of forced entry, so theoretically, he could have removed Tina Marie from her bedroom, driven her away from the scene, sexually assaulted her, and strangled her to death before tossing her body off the overpass. He then returns to the trailer while Iguan is still sleeping and climbs back into bed with her, and no one notices that Tina Marie is even gone until Lisa wakes them up at 7 o'clock. Well, putting aside the lack of motive, it's hard to imagine Jimmy pulling this off without making any noise or waking up Iguan, her other two children, and somehow remaining stoic enough not to draw any suspicion at all during the investigation. It's also worth noting that Iguan and Jimmy got married a couple years later and remained together until Jimmy passed away in August of 2014 at the age of 70. In fact, you can even find Jimmy's obituary online, and it's interesting to note that even though he was technically not yet married to Iguan at the time Tina Marie was murdered, he is still listed as being preceded in death by his stepdaughter, Tina Marie. If she had any inkling that Jimmy had harmed her daughter, I don't think Iguan would have stayed with him for the rest of his life. So considering that he was never named as a suspect or person of interest, I think we can safely rule out the idea of Jimmy being responsible for Tina Marie's death. While there were no signs of forced entry at the trailer, Iguan noticed that the back door was unlocked on the morning she discovered Tina Marie was missing, even though she was certain she had locked it the previous evening. This suggests that Tina Marie unlocked the door herself in the middle of the night, but you'd think that if her killer had showed up there and knocked on the door, someone else in the trailer would have been woken up by this. And since Tina Marie shared her bedroom with her younger sister, would someone have been able to abduct her from there without waking Lisa up? This is why I put a lot of credence in the theory that Tina Marie heard a noise outside and decided to unlock the door and go onto the backyard to check on her rabbits because she feared a stray animal may have gotten into their hutch. If the perpetrator abducted Tina Marie while she was in the backyard before fleeing the scene, this could probably account for why no one reported seeing or hearing anything. But there's still some issues with that scenario. For starters, Tina Marie's hands were tied with a gold bedsheet from her bedroom, so how could the killer have obtained this if they did not enter the trailer? I guess the most logical explanation is that if Tina Marie did go outside on her own, she may have taken the bedsheet with her and wrapped it around herself, since she was only dressed in a nightgown, and it was likely cold at that time of night. But how could this person have predicted that Tina Marie would come out of the trailer at that time? Even if the perpetrator made a noise in hopes of luring Tina Marie outside, how could they be certain it wouldn't wake up any of the adults as well and bring them outside? If the killer was a complete stranger with no known connection to Tina Marie, what are the odds that they would just happen to be in the neighborhood to witness a teenage girl exiting her trailer alone sometime between 1 and 6 a.m.? The alternate possibility is that Tina Marie could have known her killer, and on a prior occasion, this person convinced her to meet them outside in the middle of the night and proceeded to take advantage of the situation. I'm sure many of you are probably familiar with the unsolved 2000 disappearance of 9-year-old Aisha Degree, who went missing in North Carolina after making the seemingly inexplicable decision to exit her home in the middle of the night while a rainstorm was taking place. While we still don't know what actually happened in that case, one of the most prominent theories is that she was being groomed by an adult who somehow convinced her to meet them at a certain location at that time of night before they killed her and disposed of her body. Investigators have never pushed that forward as a theory in Tina Marie's case, but I do wonder if a similar scenario might have happened, where a groomer convinced her to leave her mobile home before she was abducted. But then again, the key difference in these cases is that Aisha Degree seemingly got dressed and packed her book bag when she left her home, whereas Tina Marie was still wearing a nightgown which was wrapped around her neck when her body was found. So if Tina Marie woke up and left the trailer on her own accord, then I think this suggests that she was only planning to be outside for a very short time. However, regardless of who Tina Marie's killer was, what really stands out is the pure savageness and overkill of her murder. I'm particularly disturbed by the detail that she was beaten so badly that you could apparently see some of her bones, and the perpetrator also sexually assaulted her and strangled her to death as well. It's also very odd that they would then decide to toss her body off a highway overpass, because if they really wanted to get away with this crime, the most logical approach would be to dispose of Tina Marie's body in a manner in which she would never be found. Instead, they made a public spectacle of the whole situation by dumping her body onto the middle of an interstate to be seen by motorists, so it's almost like they wanted everyone to know what they had done. James Norman Ulmer would go on to do the exact same thing to Lisa Thompson in June of 1982, but let's compare these two crimes. Obviously, the big similarity is that both victims' bodies were tossed off an overpass onto Interstate 4 at locations that were only 13 miles apart, but there were also some noticeable differences. Even though this did not occur with Tina Marie, we know that there was forced entry with Lisa's abduction, since Ulmer removed a screen from her bedroom window. And unlike Tina Marie, Lisa was not sexually assaulted, strangled, or beaten, and was still alive when Ulmer tossed her off the overpass. I've always found it so odd that Ulmer would go to the trouble of abducting Lisa and then simply drive around with her for hours without doing anything. And while 24 feet is definitely a nasty fall, it's not high enough to guarantee that someone could not survive it. So Ulmer made a major mistake by not killing Lisa beforehand or sticking around to make sure she was dead, as she wound up surviving and identifying him. Ulmer's actions seemed to fit the profile of someone who has never assaulted or killed anyone before and needed to spend all this time driving around with the victim in order to work up the will to do this. But if he had already assaulted and murdered Tina Marie 8 months earlier, why would he have this hesitation? You also have to account for the fact that Ulmer had recently broken into another house and was caught watching over a pair of young girls where they were sleeping. He was already out on bail for this offense at the time Lisa was abducted, so this was an incredibly brazen crime which did not benefit him in any way and only led to his downfall. So you have to ask if someone like that would have been capable of getting away with Tina Marie's murder. Now, even though Ulmer lived in Lakeland and had no known ties to Tina Marie or her family, he did often travel to Juanita to visit his sister and some of his friends. So it is possible that Ulmer could have seen Tina Marie during one of his visits to Juanita and set his eyes on her as a potential target for abduction. The residence he broke into during April of 1982 was also located in Juanita, and it makes sense that Ulmer would attempt to commit crimes like this in a town where he did not live. Lisa Thompson also lived in Kathleen, and I can understand why Ulmer would go after his next victim in another town after getting caught in Juanita. However, if Ulmer had no involvement in Tina Marie's murder, he easily could have read about the crime in the newspapers and used it as inspiration when he decided to get rid of Lisa's body. No evidence was ever found to prove that Ulmer killed Tina Marie, but it's worth noting that he never actually denied any involvement. He just refused to speak with investigators about the case. Part of me is inclined to believe that Ulmer is the perpetrator, because what are the odds of two separate girls being abducted from their homes in Polk County within 1 8-month span before their bodies were tossed off an overpass onto the same interstate? If Ulmer did do it, then karma ultimately got him in the end, since he died behind bars at the young age of 39. But I do think the possible involvement of Frank Potts does throw a monkey wrench into things. Even though Ulmer was never charged, it sounds like Laguan was pretty certain he killed her daughter, but was taken by complete surprise when Potts was named as a potential suspect in March of 1994. Now, we know that Potts was an awful person, since he murdered Robert Earl Gines in 1989, and he had a long history of sexually abusing multiple young girls. It's crazy to go back and read the original media coverage after Potts was charged with Gines' murder, as so many people who knew him went on the records to say that they thought he was a nice, generous man whom they never suspected would be capable of something like this. Potts' brother even publicly defended him, which would seem to point to major dysfunction in that family, considering that two of their sisters had already testified at one of his previous trials that Potts sexually abused them while they were growing up. He definitely seems like someone who would have been capable of killing Tina Marie, but it does seem that the authorities' belief that Potts was a serial killer who may have murdered as many as 15 people was probably exaggerated. While we know that Potts was an habitual sex offender who abused numerous girls, his only confirmed murder victim is Robert Earl Gines, and after 3 decades, all attempts to link him to any other unsolved crimes have been unsuccessful. I'm certainly not going to say that Potts never killed anyone else in his life, as he does have some interesting connections to other unsolved cold cases. For instance, in 1978, Potts' brother-in-law at that time, Arthur Zechman Jr., went missing while visiting the same property on Garrett Mountain where Potts killed Gines and buried his body. While it does not appear that Zechman has ever been found, an extensive search of this property failed to turn up the remains of Zechman or anyone else, so we can't say with any certainty that Potts killed him. But on the other side of the coin, when Potts' hunting cabin was searched following his arrest, the authorities discovered that it contained a fake wall, and a photograph was found behind it of 20-year-old Felicia Renee Dry, who went missing from Albertville, Alabama in June of 1993. She was reportedly last seen in the company of a man matching Potts' description, so he instantly became a suspect, but it would turn out this photograph was nothing more than a red herring. In November of 1995, Dry's remains were discovered inside a wrecked car off Highway 431 in a rural area of Etowah County, as she had simply lost control of her vehicle and driven off an embankment, so her death was nothing more than a tragic accident. Potts' motive for killing Robert Earl Gines was because he wanted Gines' girlfriend, Bobby Lee Harrell, for himself. After Gines disappeared, Potts kept Harrell inside his cabin for a while, but he ultimately did allow her to leave the property unharmed, even though she was a potential witness who could implicate him in a murder. If Potts was a serial killer who murdered multiple people and did all those horrible things to Tina Marie, would he have let Harrell go? The investigator who held the press conference to announce that Potts was a suspect in Tina Marie's murder was Major Marvin Pittman, but some people believe he may have been overzealous at trying to link Potts to so many unsolved murders. And of course, one of these people was Louis Giampavolo, the detective who later took on Tina Marie's case, as he believes that Ulmer was the most likely perpetrator. But for the sake of argument, let's look at the evidence which might point to Potts being Tina Marie's killer. Unlike Ulmer, Potts has openly denied any involvement in the crime, though I wouldn't put much stock in that, since he has never admitted any culpability for the crimes we know he did commit. Potts was living in Polk County at the time of Tina Marie's death, and while he claimed he was in North Carolina on the date she was killed, that might have been difficult to verify, given his transient lifestyle. LeGuant seemed to recall that Potts may have met Tina Marie at some point, which is certainly possible, since he worked for a fruit contractor who lived in Juanita, only a few blocks away from Tina Marie's residence. So perhaps Potts set his eyes on her and decided to follow Tina Marie home one night before he abducted her. He may have only planned on sexually assaulting Tina Marie rather than killing her, but for whatever reason, things escalated out of control and Potts wound up throwing her body off the overpass. The detail I find most interesting is that Potts' wife officially filed for divorce on October the 30th, 1981, and by the morning of October the 31st, Tina Marie was dead. It's possible this link is nothing more than a coincidence, but theoretically, if Potts learned about the divorce filing, he could have decided to take out all his rage on some innocent victim, and Tina Marie was the unfortunate target. Of course, that's all just speculation, as there is no direct evidence that links Potts with Tina Marie's murder, but even those who think Ulmer is the more likely perpetrator have acknowledged that they've never been able to completely rule out Potts as a suspect. Personally, if I had to pick between these two men, I'd say that Ulmer is the more likely candidate to be the killer, but I couldn't say that with 100% certainty. And I also won't rule out the possibility that the real perpetrator was someone who has never popped up on the radar as a suspect. I previously mentioned the possibility of Tina Marie being groomed by someone she knew, but even though she may have met Potts in passing, I doubt they were well acquainted, and I see nothing to indicate that she ever met Ulmer at all. In other words, if Tina Marie was abducted at random, then it's just rotten luck that she happened to step outside her trailer in the middle of the night while a predator was in the area. But perhaps there was someone in Tina Marie's life who convinced her to unlock the trailer's back door and step outside before they took advantage of the situation. If Ulmer or Potts was the killer, it will be difficult to conclusively prove it after all this time, since they are now both deceased. But perhaps there is someone out there with inside knowledge who could break this case wide open by coming forward. So if by chance you happen to have any information about the murder of Tina Marie Janos, please contact the Polk County Sheriff's Office at 863-298-6200. That's 863-298-6200. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This month, I released a bonus episode titled The Top 10 Dumbest Segments on Unsolved Mysteries, where I discussed some of the silliest so-called mysteries that were featured on the show. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 1988 disappearance of a ship called the Freedon, which vanished during a trip through the Caribbean from Florida to Haiti. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of those commentary tracks in our archives. Also, like I mentioned in the intro, if we manage to attain our goal of reaching 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of October, we'll be providing an additional extra special bonus for all of our patrons in November. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Leah, Serena W., and Mario. Thank you all so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us again next Wednesday for another Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.